Welcome to the Cosmosis Podcast. This is Justin Moses, and this is episode 15, and it will be filled with listener questions. This is your episode. Your questions will be answered today. But before we get into that, I've got a few things to run down. First of all, thanks to everybody who's come out to one of Sierra's recent shows. It's been a successful run so far. The crowds have been really good for the run of concerts we've done in the last few weeks. Basically, a solid month since the release of the record. And we have a couple of weeks here. Not 2 weeks, but a weekend off, basically. But I'll tell you, if you're in the East Tennessee area this Saturday, March the 5th, I think it is. Let me look on the trusty calendar here. March the 5th. I'll be in Etowah, Tennessee with the Band of Rooks playing at the Cousin Jake Memorial Bluegrass Festival. And that honors Jake Tulloch, who was the bass player, Cousin Jake, for Flat and Scruggs for many years. So if you're in that area, come out and be with us this coming Saturday. The next run of shows with Sierra will be starting out in Hammond, Louisiana, and that's on the 10th of March. The 11th will be in Birmingham, Alabama, and the 12th will be in St. Louis, Missouri. So if you're in those areas, come be with us. The 15th of March, we'll be playing a special Tuesday edition of Music City Roots here in Nashville. So you can also watch that online at musiccityroots.com if you can't be in the area. And then we begin a run of dates starting in Denver, Colorado on the 18th, Lions on the 19th. We have dates in Phoenix and in Los Angeles, San Pedro, Berkeley, California. So just check out my website and Sierra's website for the schedules. It's justinmoses.com and sierrahall.com. I wanted to tell you, too, that one of my previous guests, Tim Shelton, he was on a few months back. He has his own podcast now. It's called The Tim Shelton Show, and I'm up to episode 6, which would be the latest one, I think. I've not heard it yet, but I've heard up through 5, and I think you'll enjoy his show as well. If you like this show, you should check it out anyways. Check out episode 4 in particular. That show gives a lot of good recommendations, and he talks about the albums that were very influential to him and bluegrass. And I'll come back to that later in the show and probably give you some of mine related to one of the questions I got. But Tim has his own style. Everybody, you know, that's the fun thing about doing podcasts is everybody has their own style. Tim's show's not just about music, for sure. He wants to make it a general kind of talk show podcast, or it seems that way. And I think he would say the same thing. So if you're interested in that, be sure and check it out. And while I'm in plugging mode, I will say, if you enjoy this show, please do share it on social media. Tell your friends, family members, everybody about the show. That's what's going to help spread the word and make this podcast grow. And speaking of growing, this podcast, clips from it anyway, are going to start airing on Linda Wright's Session 2 Bluegrass show on Sunday mornings in Bristol, Tennessee. The Bristol area on terrestrial radio. So you'll have a chance if you live in that area to check out clips on her show, and hopefully more people will discover her show in that area or discover my show in that area and start listening to this podcast and vice versa. It's It's only going to be short clips and sort of as a plug to this show. So look forward to that starting soon. And today is Super Tuesday in the United States, and it's Election Day here in Tennessee. I went and voted early this morning. I count it as a privilege and a duty at the same time to vote. Since we do have the right and the privilege to vote, we should exercise that right, I think, anyways. And I know I have a lot of listeners across the globe, and it's not relevant to you necessarily, but if you're living in Tennessee or living in a state that's voting today or in the next few weeks, I encourage you to go out there and exercise your right. Today is also the first day this year that I can watch spring training games on MLB Network. I'm excited about that. My Cincinnati Reds are playing the Cleveland Indians today, and these spring training games are pretty skippable, pretty boring. It's kind of hard to sit through them, but I'm still somehow excited to just see that it's on and then watch a little bit of it and see who's actually playing today. These games early on, a lot of the star players don't really play anyway, so still got to wait for the regular season to see something that counts, but it's fun nonetheless just to check out the team, what they look like this year, and that sort of thing. That being said, let's just dive right into some listener questions today and get going with the podcast. The first one comes from Christian Andreasen, and he says, I don't expect you to answer, but great if you do. In your arrangement of Disvardia, you play with Sierra. In the second half of the A part, you and Sierra do a lightning fast triplet run from the high strings to the low and back. You know which one I mean. Question mark. I'm wondering if you do it with continuously down, up, or do you change direction towards the adjacent strings when it comes in handy, shortcutting, so to speak, in order to do it that fast? Well, I did send a reply to this one, but I'm going to use it on the podcast as well. That is an all back and forth triplet. And the arrangement that we were doing there is just, it's from Mike Marshall. And he had introduced that tune to Sierra at the Mandolin Symposium out in California a couple years back. And then we started doing it in some of the duo shows we were doing for a while there. Not really doing any of those at the moment, but it's totally back and forth on the pick strokes on that. And it does take some practice. For me, it was learning it slow at first. Learning it slow and just speeding up. Keeping on trying to do it a little faster. Till I got it where we wanted it. All right, Doug Walker wrote and said, hey, stumbled upon your music thanks to iTunes. Great stuff, young man. I know you're busy, but I did want to ask one question. What is the name and the tune on YouTube featuring Cody Kilby, Sierra Hall, and an unnamed fourth musician? Concert window highlight. Thanks for your time. Okay, well, the unnamed musician was Scott Mulvihill, and I think he is named either on the video itself or the description one, but that is a show that I did from my living room last year. I think it was early in the year. But Cody, Sierra, and Scott and myself worked up some of the tunes that ended up being on my EP. I was currently working on them at the time. And we mixed in one of Cody's tunes and one of Scott's tunes and played the mandolin duo that Sierra and I had been doing, which was Cold Day off of my record, and one of her tunes called E-Tune that is now in the sets that we're playing as a trio, and she does that with Ethan playing bass, just the two of them. Jamie Hodnett says, pretty sure that was you in a Dan Tominski music video, Wheels. Well, Jamie, yes, that was me in the video, Wheels. It's not one exactly a question, but I will answer it on here and say yes. I was the ventriloquist in the Wheels video. If you want to see that and you've not seen it, just search YouTube for Dan Tominski Wheels and you'll come across it. I played the comedy role in that video. It was pretty fun to do, actually. We went out to California and rode a train from Oakland, California to Los Angeles and back. And it was really nice, super nice. And the whole trip was a lot of fun. It was during a trip where we played the Huck Finn Bluegrass Festival and the Grass Valley Festival. But speaking of Huck Finn, actually, this year we'll be doing a Dan Tominski Band reunion show there at Huck Finn. So if you're interested in that, definitely check out the Huck Finn Festival this week or this year. It's June the 11th will be the date on that. I've got kind of a long question here from Owen that I sort of addressed on the podcast with Tim Stafford, but I'm going to address it myself here a little bit more. So he says, "Hi, Justin. I recently sent you a Facebook message and have since then continued to listen to and enjoying the podcast. On the episode with Tim Shelton, he talked a little about moving away from bluegrass and how that decision resulted in some hostility from people who saw that as, quote, quitting. I'm a drummer and a guitar player who comes from a blues background, and I think there is some definite overlap in respect to how blues purists and bluegrass purists react when someone moves into some other genres and expands their musical horizons. At any rate, though, his comments got me to thinking about how much my musical tastes have expanded over the last few years, and I am at a point now where what I listen to and on a day-to-day basis and what I play each night when I go out and play gigs are not really the same thing. I, of course, still listen to blues, and I still love playing that music, but when I buy a new album, I'm usually on the hunt for something different than what I typically play live. For example, over the last year, I've been on a pretty steady bluegrass kick. So my question is for you and your guests. I'm sure that while most of you got your start in bluegrass, still play that music and love that music, what other genres and styles are on your playlists? Are there sometimes wild differences between the music that you make your living playing and the music you consume? And along those same lines, have interests in other kinds of music ever made you want to explore totally different styles of playing your instruments? For example, my first love was the sound of an electric blues guitar, but lately I have devoted much more effort into learning how to flat pick an acoustic guitar. I know this has been long-winded, so I apologize for that, but looking forward to hearing more episodes and some discussion on the topic sometime." Okay. Yes, same here, basically, would be the short answer, but to a certain degree, bluegrass is my first love, and it probably always will be. I still enjoy listening to bluegrass. I find myself more so wanting to listen to older bluegrass, the original bluegrass, really. The music of Bill Monroe and the Stanley Brothers and Flatt & Scruggs. That's really spoken to me more recently than anything new that's come out. And I could say anything new that's come out for a while, I would say. Now, yeah, if you just look at what I listen to on a day-to-day basis, I don't listen to as much music these days as I had in the past. You know, I have Sirius satellite radio, and I do listen to the Bluegrass Channel occasionally. I flip through it and see what's playing. I really enjoy listening to, for instance, Chris Jones's show. That's the title's escaping me at this moment, but it's Truegrass. Yeah. So he plays a lot of older stuff on there. I really like that. So other than that, I have the Pop Station, the Channel 2 basically programmed in as a preset. I go to that and just kind of amuse myself, see what's there. Sometimes I listen to a lot of talk radio, but things that I listen to can widely vary from what I play on a night-to-night basis. don't have anything specific that I'm just into. I'm just into what I'm into. I like what I like. You know, I like Coldplay, for instance. You know, a lot of people I know don't like Coldplay, but that's one of the bands that just grabbed my attention. Maroon 5. I like Maroon 5. You know, it's just a wide variety, really. You know, I'm not very much into country, into modern country especially. I'm not even as into older country as a lot of people I know in bluegrass that are. It's not that I have any negative feelings toward it. I'm just not into it as much as some people are. But we all have different tastes, you know, and that's what makes us individuals. And that's who I am, I guess. But let's do a lot of older bluegrass, some pop, rock, that sort of stuff. And I enjoy getting exposed to different music and playing with different people from time to time and traveling with different people. Sort of naturally exposes you to things that you might not hear otherwise, because they might say, here, I've got something that I want to play you. And so, for instance, Ethan Yojevitz, that plays with Sierra now, we travel around, and he likes a lot of old time, and that's stuff that I've not heard a whole lot of, but I'm getting exposed to it a little bit more, and I like it. And he's played some classical things in the band that I really like. I have a huge affinity for that. I like general. My number one thing is I love the sound of acoustic instruments, whatever they're doing, whatever they're playing, and you know, whatever style you want to put on it. I like to hear fiddles, for instance, playing. So if you've got really good fiddle players playing fiddle music, I'm probably going to like it, you know. So I hope that somewhat addresses that question. Because basically I know you're not alone, Owen, in that you don't always play on stage what you're listening to. This discussion has reminded me to mention that there's an article in No Depression magazine recently about Sierra and the Steep Canyon Rangers, and they're sort of expanding their musical horizons a little bit. This goes back to what I was saying, though, about I really like to listen to the older, more original bluegrass. It was brought to my attention that somebody took issue with Ted Lehman, who wrote the article, his assessment of that, that they're moving in the right direction, that they're doing the right thing by expanding their horizons and going in the direction that they see fit. And he was the guy, I'm not sure even what his name is still, but that he named a band or two, and in particular, and said that they were sort of carrying the banner forward for bluegrass, and that, you know, Sierra had just abandoned it, basically. And a thought that comes to my mind is that the bands that the guy mentioned, which aren't the people that I like, and hopefully someday I can even have them on this podcast, but the idea that they're carrying the banner forward for traditional bluegrass, well, maybe so, but at the same time, you have to define what you mean by traditional bluegrass, because they don't really resemble, like, Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys that much. They don't really resemble the Stanley Brothers or Flatt & Scruggs that much. They more so resemble bands that came into popularity in the 90s or the 2000s. So it just gets to be a little bit funny to talk about bluegrass, what is bluegrass and what's not, because, you know, very little of the music that's being put out these days really resembles the music of Bill Monroe. But the next question comes from Dan Solomon. Actually, he has two good questions. I'm going to go with the second one first. The recent Sirius Channel 61 preemption for Hanukkah songs concerned me a little because I was worried about about a possible anti-Semitic backlash from the bluegrass community. In parentheses, he says, I don't think it happened. He says, I'm Jewish, and I'm fascinated with people like Grisman, Statman, Fleck, Pacalny, who have been successful in music but came from come from far different backgrounds than people, for example, from East Tennessee. Do you distinguish between people who have grown up in the bluegrass tradition and others who have, quote, come to the music on their own? And I did write him back personally about this and in his second question as well. But I don't really make that distinction. I don't think about it right off the top of my head when I think of those artists for sure. But I think we naturally, when we meet somebody or we find out that, oh, there's this person that also likes this kind of music, you notice differences in the same way that I notice differences in anybody I meet. It really doesn't have any effect whatsoever on me whether I value their input or not. I'm going to value it, especially those people he mentioned, because of their abilities, talents, their acumen for doing it, regardless of where they came from. That's really the only answer I have for that, is that I really don't automatically make the distinction most of the time, like what your heritage is. I'm fascinated about it sometimes when I realize, when it does strike me. It's no secret, really, that there's very few African Americans, for instance, that play bluegrass or in it. So, like, say if an African American, you know, you see one at a festival or you know, somebody is playing a bluegrass instrument, it strikes me because it's just a rarity, you know, not for any other reason. Me personally, I welcome everybody into the circle that wants to play bluegrass or roots music. I think it's very cool that you would want to. So I would say that I'm for being welcoming, let's say. His second question is, I would be interested in hearing you discuss the many personnel changes in bluegrass and why that happens. It seems the bluegrass community is tight-knit, and I'm curious how those changes could affect relationships between the musicians. Is there bad blood? Do people leave bands for financial reasons? Obviously, I'm not asking for specifics, but just your views in general. Now, this is one I really think is a good question, one that we can take some time and delve into a little deeper. Yeah, there are a lot of changes in bluegrass bands, and why that happens is like so many reasons that we probably wouldn't have time to get to all of them, or couldn't think of all of them, because there's always new things coming up. You know, every day there's a new reason why this band couldn't get along or why it just wouldn't work. As for the question on, do people leave bands for financial reasons? Absolutely. I've done that myself. I think it's just a part of it. So let's talk about this for a second. So having a band, it means different things to different people. And what I mean by that is some bands get together just because they're friends and they want to make music. They want to have fun with it. It's not this business to them, you know, just starting out wanting to play. But at the point that the music or the band becomes a business, things change. The dynamic changes, you know, because once it becomes a business, you have to figure out who's going to be responsible for what part of it. Now, this is talking about a band that's a equal partnership between everybody, you know, like there's a lot to figure out in that situation. There are bands that are configured in all kinds of different ways. A lot of people, a lot of times you have a star that has a band, and they hire musicians to be in their band. So that's a different arrangement. You've got a boss in that situation where really it's like any other job. You either please your boss or you don't have a job at some point, And so that becomes problematic for a lot of reasons, just like any other job would. And then you have partnerships where, you have maybe a duo that there are two people that are in charge. And so they have to get along with each other, and then they have to agree on decisions concerning the rest of the band as well. So there's all these ways of having a band configured, and each one of them present different challenges and different problems, different reasons that someone might want to change. And does it affect relationships between the musicians? It absolutely does. There's no denying that. It's just like it is with your family or close friends. If you have any sort of relationship that's a real relationship, somewhere along the line you're going to have conflict or disagreements. It's inevitable. It's human nature that no two of us are alike, basically 100% of the time. You have to figure out how to work with people. It's one of the most important things that you have to realize if you're interested in playing music, like as a road musician, that it's not just knowing how to play music that's going to make you successful. That can be a big part of it. It should be the biggest part of it, but you really have to know how to get along with people. And for me, that means paying attention and understanding what makes people upset or makes people happy. What are you doing that is helping the situation or hurting the situation? So I'm going to take some examples from my own experience, because I think that's the best way to illustrate some things. And times passed, and a lot of things have been gotten over through the years. I definitely try not to hold grudges or to just hold on to things longer than it needs to be. For me, I am in the music business because I want to make a good living at it. It's not just something that I have fun at. I do have fun playing music, but it's also my income. So I take it rather seriously, and I think more seriously than some people that I know for sure. But and that's caused that it in of itself has caused friction in the past. If you have different people that are thinking of it on different levels, it's kind of natural that might cause some friction at some point, because what you think needs to happen may not be what they think needs to happen. So compromise is key if you want to continue that relationship, both musically and personally. So talking from my own personal experience, one of the things that I have done the wrong way, and I think this is good advice that I can give to people moving forward, is don't send emails about the business, about things that can be emotional about the business. Just don't send emails, period, basically. Call the person and talk about it. If you've got an issue, call them and do it. If you're going to email, read it out loud. Make sure it's something that you would actually say to the person and not just send through emails. Now, I've done that several times through the years. I'm definitely not proud of it, but you know, it, you grow from learning. And several times through the years, yeah, I've sent emails about the business that have been overly aggressive or just not saying the things that you would say if you were just talking directly to the person. And that has caused conflicts. Email about logistics and things like that. One band I was in particular, I was in it twice. The first time I was a partner in the band, an original member. And the second time I was hired into the band. My first exit from the band was just because of a disagreement with the other guys. Disagreement over what I perceived to be business decision. And really, in a lot of ways, I know that maybe I wasn't even right, but you go a lot of times with what you feel in the moment is right. And so that led to me leaving the band. And when I came back, I was hired on, and that made its own dynamic interesting, you know. And the eventual exit the second time was for financial reasons. And I would advise people in this regard, if you're in a business sort of band, if you're making money, if you're making your living off of it especially, be very specific about how you get paid. And that can eliminate some of the gray areas, you know. I wasn't necessarily hung up on money, but I was hung up on what I perceived to be fairness or unfairness, you know, concerning a day, a specific day where multiple shows were going to be played. And not to rehash something that was long ago, I might even feel different about it now, but, you know, changing bands sometimes leads to different opportunities that might not be there had you stayed in that, you know, in a certain situation. So another one of the bands I was in, I left because of sort of like creative differences, you could say. I just wanted to do something different for sure. I had no ill feelings toward anybody in particular. I know I just didn't feel like it was the place for me. And I did have times when I came home from that job and just didn't feel good about it. I was kind of hateful and just all around wasn't the experience that I was looking for. And so I was on my way out of that when another opportunity came up that I had to take. Okay, and for instance, with the Dan Tominski band, that ended mostly not of any of our choosing. Maybe somebody did have some say in that, but for the most part, we all liked playing with each other and wanted to continue on some level. There were, you know, financial considerations in that regard too, but mainly Allison just started you know, playing and touring again, and Dan and Barry had to go back and do that, and Ron and Adam had to consider, you know, another way forward. So that one ended. That's kind of a strange circumstance where we played for a couple of years while Allison was touring with Robert Plant. Now, with Ricky Skaggs, obviously, you know, Ricky's band was not a band. It was a star, somebody that was a genuine country star in the early 80s especially. And, you know, came back to bluegrass in the late 90s and has a, you know, so established, has a band. You're hired to work for Ricky Skaggs in that situation. And my exit from that band, really based more on my own personal ambition to be more than a side man than anything else. And I've still not figured out, obviously, the avenue for which I want to like propel myself forward, musically speaking. But I'm enjoying playing with Sierra. I played with her before leaving Ricky's band, and I still do. And that's all well and fine, but it was my personal desire not to get pigeonholed into the sideman character in a band like that that led to me doing that, more than any, you know, financial considerations or personal issues. I didn't have personal issues with anybody there for sure either. I've had very few personal issues through the years, and generally I really try to get along with people, because I know that's very important. But the things you got to consider, basically, if you're going to be in a band, you're basically roommates with those people. You're traveling around with them a lot of times in tight quarters. Even the more successful you are, the more ability you have to have your own time and escape, you know, be by yourself and that sort of thing, which for me is a positive thing. I need my space sometimes. Just the way that I am, because I think part of it's being an only child and learning to sort of at an early age play by myself and be content, you know, just with myself. But yeah, so if you're roommates with somebody and you're always around them, you've got to learn to cope with their needs and the things that they're used to as well as your own. And sometimes that can be problematic for people, you know, on different levels. Aside from just regional or cultural differences you may have with somebody that you're trying to be in a band with, they also may have just personal quirks that can get on your nerves over time. Something that seems little and is little, like over a period of weeks and months, can build up into something that that aggravates you on a greater level than it would if you're just seeing that person every now and again. But there are all these stories from bands from the past, ways that they've broken up. And if you get a chance, check out the Sam Bush documentary, where he talks about, you know, one of the people that he played with, you know, coming to a show and trying to encourage all the people there not to go watch the show. People really get seriously upset with each other and do crazy things sometimes. I mean, and you can, obviously there's a lot of stories about Lester Flatt and Bill Monroe not getting along, you know, for a long time, that sort of thing, you know, and a lot of times it ends up like with jealousy over somebody's success or any number of things. But the finances, that's one big issue that causes conflict. The other would be creative direction. And to me, those are probably the main two things, but there's plenty of things that could cause conflict in bands, cause changes in bands. People's personal need at the time, maybe you get married and maybe you need a little bit more time to spend with your wife, and or you're going to have a child and you don't want to be on the road all the time. Well, that'll cause a change, you know, in a band. Your life changes affect, you know, your ability to function within a unit of some sort. I think my personal opinion is good leadership is one of the keys to keeping something together. Whether that's a democratic band where everybody has a vote, a voice, or if it's, you know, you're working for somebody. If you're working for somebody that's a good leader, that has clear ideas of what they want from you and they can express that to you, then it's a lot easier to deal with a situation than having a lot of people have say, but nobody taking command, nobody really agreeing. I mean, just let's just face it. You're not going to have four or five people together that can even agree on where to eat, for instance. That can become very difficult. Even a decision as seemingly, you know, innocuous as that, can become very frustrating because just not everybody's going to be on the same page all the time on stuff like that. And communication is so important. I can't stress that enough. You have to learn to be a good communicator of your ideas and making sure that you express yourself in a way that the other person does understand exactly what you mean and is not mistaken. I watched that happen a lot just through the years. I watched people say something and then another person respond in a way that lets me know they didn't really get what the person was saying. They took it a different way. Now, no matter how well you communicate and express yourself, sometimes people are going to mistake your words. That's also a part of life. But you can learn to communicate directly with people on their level a lot of times, or learn how to get across what you're wanting to get across better than maybe you did before. I think that's something you can grow at. But those are just a few of the challenges and the ways that bands can fracture and come apart, and eventually changes are made. I might even pick up again if I think about this and think of some things I didn't say. I might pick it up on a later episode, and because I think it's an interesting topic. Bands are difficult creatures to maintain, to make work. Or they definitely can be. I know that there has to be a way some bands can make it look easy. But I guarantee you, even the bands that look like they're having the best time in the world, somewhere along the line, there's issues. There's problems, you know, that they're dealing with. And the better you are at attacking those issues and facing them, overcoming them, the more successful you're going to be as a band. My final listener question today comes from Chris Warnick. And he says, so over the years, I've heard so much about the J.D. Crow and the New South album referred to as Rounder 44 album. I've Googled it several times and tried searching music apps like Spotify for it, but can't seem to find what it is. Can you help me out? It seems so mysterious to me. Everyone else but me seems to know about it. This could be a question for your Q&A podcast, of which I'm such a fan. Thanks. All right. Chris, yes, the Rounder 44 album does exist. It's not a myth. His title was the Rounder 44 album. Is it really real? That was the subject line of his email, but it is indeed. When I first saw this question, I kind of thought it was tongue-in-cheek a little bit, but maybe you're serious. The J.D. Crow and the New South album is just titled J.D. Crow and the New South, so that's the only thing that you need to search to find the album. It's the original recording of J.D., Tony Rice, Ricky Skaggs, Bobby Sloan, and Jerry Douglas. And man, was that an influential album, and was it one of the greatest bluegrass albums ever made. I was introduced to that album through a friend of mine who burned me, or not burned me, but copied off some cassettes for me. He copied that one, the Skaggs and Rice album, the Old and the Way album, the Tone Poems by David Grisman and Tony Rice, Blake and Rice, Norman Blake, Tony Rice album, and just several things that were highly influential to me. I think some of the Bluegrass Album Band recordings that I didn't have at the time. And a lot of people may be down on the idea of copying cassettes or burning CDs and that sort of stuff. And I understand that. I'm kind of down on it myself these days. But I also look back at the days where people were doing that for me when I was coming up learning what bluegrass was. That was important to me to get that, because I was raised in a area and in a family that wasn't real rich, didn't have a whole lot of money, and I might not have heard a lot of that stuff, period, if people hadn't have given it to me. And I'm the kind of person that I think of it like this. I think there's probably a lot of people like me in that I love that stuff so much that when I got the ability, I did buy those records later. Or most of them, you know, the ones that I really loved, I bought actual copies of later. And I think that people are willing to do that when they realize the value in it. I mean, I certainly did. There was great value in me just getting my hands on that music and absorbing it. So this was the question that goes back to what I was saying with Tim Shelton's podcast, episode 4, where he named a bunch of influential records. This was one of them, the J.D. Crow and the New South album. Well, I'll also say, Chris, I just did a Google search while I was talking there, and the album cover definitely comes up under the images. If you can look at that out, it's the first image that comes up on Google. If you can look for that on iTunes when you search J.D. Crow and the New South, you will have found Rounder 44. Now, 44 just meant it was the 44th album released on Rounder Records. That's why it's called Rounder 44. That's not the title of it. It's just something that's been called because it is the serial number 44. Anyways, so when I got into bluegrass, the first record that I really can say that I was exposed to as a bluegrass record was by Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver, and the title of that one was Treasures Money Can't Buy. Now that had Doyle Lawson playing the mandolin, Jim Mills on the banjo, Shelton Fizell on the bass, and John Bowman playing guitar and singing tenor. And I remember hearing Jim Mills play the banjo on that record and recognizing that banjo playing as something different. Like, wow, I hadn't heard the banjo sound quite like that before. And so that album was really influential on me. Once we heard that album, and we also had seen Alison Krauss and Union Station on Austin City Limits, we really got into that sound and found out that there was a guy that sat up every Sunday at the flea market in Sweetwater and sold cassettes, because that's what everybody was buying at the time. And so also I grew up in the South, southern states of the United States. Tennessee is in the Bible Belt, is what people call it. And so I was raised going to church every Sunday. And every Sunday after Sunday school, my dad would drive us. This was when I was a preteen or early teenage years, you know, 12, 13, 14, something like that. He would drive us over to Sweetwater, Tennessee, to the big flea market over there, and we would get a new batch of cassettes. You know, that was what we were doing at the time to learn more about the music, to expose ourselves to more bluegrass music, because we were really interested in it. And if I can remember, I'm going to give you some of the albums that were really influential on me during that period. So that Doyle Lawson, Treasures Money Can't Buy, first and foremost. And then I remember we got Third Time Out's record called Grandpa's Mandolin. And that had Russell Moore, of course, lead singing. It had Wayne Benson on the mandolin. Barry Abernathy played the banjo and sang on that. Ray Deaton on the bass and bass vocals. And Mike Hargrove. And that was a record that had a lot of influence on me because it's one of the early things I remember hearing that gave me an idea of what modern bluegrass was. And so, you know, the guy was very kind over there, and every week that we went, he would recommend new stuff. So, you know, through the weeks and months that we were going there and getting new music, you know, I got my hands on the Lonesome River Band Old Country Town record. You know, that was an influential piece of music there for me at the time. Lou Reed and Terry Baucom, the Carolina Moon, just the original one with, I think it was self-titled, and then the Carolina Moon album. They had Clay Jones playing guitar on it, and Lou Reed, Terry Baucom, and Marcus Smith played the bass on that stuff. Got introduced to the Bluegrass Cardinals. Don't remember exactly which records that would have been at the time, but definitely remember hearing those hearing that band during that period. Heard a band called Traditional Grass that featured Joe Mullins playing the banjo. And if you like good traditional bluegrass, that's a band to go check out. The record that we first got was one called I Believe in the Old Time Way. And man, I still love hearing that music. I don't know if I have that in digital format yet, but now that I'm talking about it, maybe that'll make me go look it up and see if it's available. But many more Dual Austin's records were gotten soon there after, including the Rock My Soul gospel album that Doyle Austin had made. And man, that's one of the great bluegrass gospel albums ever made, for sure. If you don't have that one and you like bluegrass gospel at all, you should check that one out. The singing on there is second to none for just, you know, traditional bluegrass harmonies. We got a hold of Alison Krauss and Union Station's Every Time You Say Goodbye on cassette. And can't say enough good about that. Now, some of these are the same ones that Tim mentioned. He did mention that record, and he mentioned Larry Sparks' Silver Reflections. And I don't want to give away all his spiel because I want you to go listen to his podcast as well. But I want to share some of mine, too. And that one definitely goes into that category for me. I ended up getting all of Allison's previous records at that point. Got a great record by from a guy by the name of Ricky Wasson, who went on later to be in J.D. Crow's band for many years. But he made a bluegrass gospel record that had Alison Krauss on it, and just because her name is on it, you know, led us to checking it out, and got to hear what an incredible singer he is, and really enjoyed that one. Not sure I can remember the name of that record. I was exposed to a band called The New Tradition through some of those cassettes that we got at the flea market over there. Anyways, I was just in to my parents' house this past weekend. I should have looked through some of those cassettes that are still there and figured out a few more of the ones that were really influential to me. I will try to do that this weekend because I'm going back there since I'm playing right down there in that area. And maybe update that on a later podcast as well, because I do think that that's always an interesting topic, too, is just things that were influences through the years that are important, and music that maybe a lot of you don't know of, but you could search out these days and hear it. So that's going to wrap up the podcast for today. I really appreciate you listening in, and I appreciate the questions that you've sent in. I appreciate you helping share this podcast on social media and spreading the word. And I still encourage you to subscribe on iTunes and send in your reviews and rate the show. It helps out a lot. And I appreciate all the kind words that I've gotten. I've gotten a lot of nice emails, and I can see, you know, basically where people are listening from. It gives us that data. I don't know your name. I don't know anything else about you other than just that the number of listens and where you're from and the device, that sort of thing. So don't worry. Nobody's collecting, you know, your personal information, who you are. But it is nice to see that people are listening in Japan, for instance, and in France, and just all around the world. So I'm really grateful for that, and for giving it a chance. And hope you'll tune in next time. Not sure what the show's going to be yet. Shooting for a couple interviews. If I don't get the interviews, then I'll have another topic to discuss, some more things to go through. But in any regard, till next time, thanks a lot.